Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, welcome to this week's FX Guide Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. I'm joined by Mike Seymour here in Sydney.
Hey, John.
Well, it's been a good week at FX Guide, and for our podcast this week, we're going to be talking a little bit about our sister site, FX PhD.
And also about the Genesis camera that we shot with in Queensland. And we've got an interview with Andrew Collier from Panavision discussing the use of the Genesis camera and the workflow around digital cinematography.
And the reason we have that interview with him happens to be the fact that we utilized the Genesis camera on our shoot for Term 2 for FX PhD.
And wasn't that fun? That was way fun.
It was really incredible. We had that. We had Steve Newman, DOP, from Superman Returns fame.
And Babe. And, did Ghost Ship. Did a whole bunch of stuff, actually.
Really great visual effects DOP, too, as well.
Mike
and I were on set, and we're sitting there talking about stuff, and anytime Steve would say something, we'd just like look at each other and go, oh, my God, what is he? Can we like carry him in our pocket to other shoots?
Yeah, like we'd like a stuffed and mounted version of Steve Newman to roll out at any other shoot to tell the DOP what to do. It was amazing. As Steve went through issues, he'd be like, before we had a chance to say, well, as a visual effects supervisor, what I'd like is, he'd be like, well, as a DOP, I like to shoot a very even green screen. I like to have the levels like this. I like to solve this problem. I want to avoid roto because that can take a lot of time and be a really boring exercise. And we're like, yeah.
We're not worthy.
We're not worthy.
So it was really great. And basically that shoot, we've got a lot of great footage from. It's going to be, of course, HD formatted footage of a motion control rig that we shot, a motion control oil rig, and a different scale model of a tug that's going to form some of the footage that we're going to be using during the term.
Yeah, we were 20:1 scale on the tug, looking up at the oil rig, which was 10:1 scale. No, other way around? No, that's...
Tugs.
Let me do that again. We were shooting the tug at 10:1,
yep.
And the miniature looking up behind it was 20:1, which was an oil rig. And we shot the background in about 7, I think, passes, and we shot the foreground in about 2.
Yeah, so it's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to use that footage in a multitude of classes throughout the term and also provide that footage to the people who've registered at FX PhD so they can follow along, do the composite themselves, tweak it in the ways they want, and in the end have a really nice piece for their reel. I mean, it's really some nice-looking footage. We actually had to, on one of the things, actually, when it, dumb down the green screen or kind of trash up the green screen just a little bit to have a little bit of learning exercises for us and how to key as well.
Yeah, what was interesting, we did some interesting stuff with tungsten lights on the ship pass.
Yeah.
And but on the other passes, I mean...
Oh, that's some of the nicest green screen I've ever seen. Yeah. He put a slop lighting up the first day, and we grabbed it in. We had a G5 on set, and we're grabbing 444 into the G5 in real time. And Tal, one of our professors at FX PhD, was there. And he's just, oh, the sliding's not right. We just grabbed it, and, it was probably like 90% of the way there. And an easy roto, even if you wanted to, but it was a really beautiful. Got even better in the end. So he had to add a huge amount of light to photograph the tug in order to deal with depth of field issues.
Yeah, no, it was a really good shoot, and I think the really important thing is that this is the sort of real-world, high-end, this is the pipeline off Superman Returns miniature shoot, and this is the stuff that we like students to be able to get access to, because, if you're going to do training, you want to do it on real stuff, and of course, if you've got access to all that footage yourself, then in any number of the classes that you do with us, you'll be able to use that, and, hopefully do something that you're happy to put on your showreel. I know, if I was studying, I'd love to have a high-end miniatures shoot multi-pass thing I can put on my showreel. That would be great.
Yeah, exactly. This kind of quality is just like I would have jumped for. It's actually amazing. So our new term is actually starting up next week with orientation week.
And I think, as I said last week on the podcast, we basically doubled in size from where we were before. So some of the classes that we'll be doing this term, for example, like the Mayer class will be fun. That's a Mayer effects class.
Mm-hmm.
And so that'll be taking the oil rig footage and putting explosions, rain, sprays of water coming up, tarpaulins flapping in the wind, little fires burning, all that kind of additional effects 3D stuff to really sell the shot. So it's going to be like loads of stuff. I guess I'm looking forward to that one a lot. Are there any particular ones that you're looking forward to, John?
I'm actually looking forward to the DaVinci color grading course, because I think that's really interesting. That's something people, I think in general, haven't had access to, even through like a DVD. And from my standpoint, I'm not going to go and necessarily sit in front of the DaVinci. which you did actually shot with Warren Eagles at the Fox Studios down here. But I think I'm going to just pick up a lot through osmosis, watching the course, and be able to kind of, you know, better deal with a telecine grading session actually when I go in there.
Yeah, and what was also nice, and this will not be the majority of the course. The majority of the course is in front of the DaVinci grading, but yeah. Warren was on set in Queensland, so he actually interviewed a bunch of the DOPs, including Steve and quite a few other DOPs, to discuss the relationship between a director of photography and a colorist, and also the increasing role of the DI in the filmmaking process, which I think was... There's some interesting comments there.
I think another interesting thing we're going to be offering, too, is we've been testing the first term, is we're really happy now, so we're going to be offering a version of Toxic 2007 via VPN, so that if you have a... yeah, exactly. It's been a long process. If you have access to a Windows XP machine that meets the spec for the install, we have a special semi-standalone version. I mean, it's probably not as robust as the actual release version, because Autodesk was really kind enough to help us out and figure a way to get our students to have access to the software. But we've been testing it pretty successfully in the last couple of weeks, and it's been a fun process. So
John, if I install that, I can do what with it in terms of Toxic? I mean, what's it going to have in it?
Well, you can do anything that you can with Toxic. There are certain collaboration features that I haven't tried to work on, since it runs on a single system. You're not going to have the kind of collaboration features that you would ordinarily. But as far as actually creating composites, finding your way around the UI, the tools,
so
everything,
HDR,
it's going to HDR, everything. Grading. You're going to really be able to learn and understand the software using our VPN version. So I really think it's invaluable. I mean, so much of it at this point has been kind of watching trade shows and going and seeing a demo. And
you can read the entire works of Sigmund Freud, but sooner or later you've got to take a girl out on a date.
Yeah, exactly. So
get your hands on it.
We're going to repeat the Toxic 101 course, which, because we didn't have it available when we were doing that, that's kind of more of a theory of the underlying architecture and the collaboration and such. And in the second level of our introductory course, we're going to start building and doing more with compositing. Again, both of those things very introductory in nature to kind of introduce you to the Toxic architecture.
Another couple of really huge ones is the Combustion course and the Photoshop course.
Yep.
I think Combustion was really heavily came up in our research as something that people wanted to do.
Yeah, it's really, really requested that people wanted to have a class with that. And one of our returning professors from our first term, Gary Davis, who's, you know, I think he's been involved with Combustion back in his days at Denham. I mean, he's been involved in it for forever, paint and effect days, you know, and so forth. So he'll be teaching that one. And then we have our first female professor who's going to be teaching our Photoshop course, which is a Photoshop class for effects with a little bit of design mixed in, which I think will be fun.
Yeah.
But that's Rose Draper who will be covering that class. And she's done some work for you on that Hunt Angels feature.
Yeah. I worked with her on Hunt Angels, and there was, I mean, you know, she does feature film Photoshop stuff as well as Combustion and other things. And what's interesting there is that she'll be tackling, you know, a whole range of stuff that is relevant if you're an effects artist. It's not... you know, okay, this is how to, you know, do stuff, I don't know.
CD cover.
Exactly, yeah. It's stuff that's relevant, stuff that'll make your work faster and affects things in particular, like matte paintings and dealing with integrating live action with old footage, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, that's one of the things about this course and the shoot that we just got done doing up in Queensland is, you know, each of the classes is going to have a little part in building that final composite, and they're going to be kind of interacting with each other. So Rose is actually the person who's doing the matte painting for that. So Rose is doing the matte painting for that. We've got Dean who's doing the Maya particle effects. We're going to be doing the compositing in both Shake and Toxic.
And Dean's our first professor from Japan, which
yeah.
is cool.
Yeah.
He's been doing gaming stuff up there. And it's nice to get someone from the gaming background in to PhD as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, that's the way it's going to work. And, again, there's a ton of information on the FX PhD website and also a little promo tease. You can kind of get a glimpse of some of the stuff that was on set last weekend. But
yeah. We're also going to, of course, be coming back with Flame and Background Fundamentals.
Yep.
And Background Fundamentals got a pretty good reaction, as did the Flame course, actually.
Mm-hmm. So it's a different Flame course, we might add, though. I did an expressions course in term one. I think a lot of people, it was really nice to get a lot of good feedback from that. But this one, it's our first 300-level course,
and there are
going to be several of us tag-teaming on it. It's going to cover keying and particles. Mike and I were just talking about how great it will be to do a Flame course.
Yeah, we love Flame.
And do a little bit of some batch editing, some 10-bit workflow in batch, some clip history stuff, and other things. So it's going to be a tag team effort, but a lot of advanced concepts and advanced things within Flame that are above the basic level. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, so I think there are 14 courses in total, and registration's open now. You actually, maybe you should just step through that, John. If somebody goes to the website now, just to set their expectations of how that's going to run.
Yeah. Well, you can take a look. We have a page with just kind of an overview of everything on how FXPhD works, the structure of it, how you get classes, how many classes can you take, what's the cost, things like that. We have a page that lists the courses so you can see what courses we're offering. And then basically what you do is you sign up and pay. And once you do that, the actual registration of when you select your classes is going to be happening during the end of next week. And I'll say next week here, which is the week of August 21st.
So in other words, when you sign up and pay, you don't pick your courses then. And the reason for that is there's a period where we try and expose you as much as we can to what's going to be in the courses so that you don't have to pick courses before you've got any idea what's in them.
Yeah, so we'll be rolling that out. And the other thing is that during that first week, too, the first 7 days of classes, you can actually switch around your courses so it'll enable you to essentially sample all the classes. So if you sign up for a class and you think, okay, maybe this is too advanced for me and I want to take a step back or vice versa, you have some time to do that within the first, 10 days or so of the term that gives you that kind of flexibility.
And then for those of you that don't know, what happens is each week you get an email sent to you, and you can then BitTorrent download the class, which might be, a 30-minute discussion of, well, like last term, for example, a 30-minute discussion of how to shoot for optical flow. You would BitTorrent that down. If you're not comfortable with BitTorrent for any reason, then you can actually download it just with a normal click and download link, but that happens the week following. And then there is a whole lot of stuff going on in the forums, and we'll be increasing the sort of email communication with students this term as well.
That's the thing about this is that, if you're like me, you probably have several DVD training DVDs and so forth, but the thing about this is you get this class, your professors are online, the other students are online, so you can discuss the class, discuss issues that come up during the class and get answers really quickly. So you're not working in a vacuum, and I think that's what really sets FXPhD apart from other people, in addition to, I think, the really high-quality footage that you're getting along with the...
Yeah, and we actually have some really cool announcements we're doing midterm about tutorials and stuff, but as always, I'm getting ahead of myself, and I should
be great.
Slapped down by John later, but we really are pushing the envelope in terms of technology to try and make it as interactive and as... Because, I'm the same, John. I've bought DVDs and thought that somehow I would learn by having them sitting behind me on the shelf, having never actually got them out. It's like, who has 3 hours to get into something? Whereas I can definitely, during a render or whatever.
And I really also, the other thing I really have learned to appreciate, and maybe it's also through FXGuide, but it's the worldwide community.
Oh, yeah.
That's part of FXPhD, especially in, you wake up and there's, the 24-hour cycle of postings. You've got people in Germany. There's a guy there who's running Toxic, Vancouver. We were involving a guy in Vancouver, some testing.
There's the guy in Iceland.
Iceland.
We love that guy, man.
Exactly. So it's a lot of fun.
South Africa. Some of the South African guys won Challenge 2, I think. In the last. Yeah. No, it's great. It's really been a huge success. We're really keen to have more people join up because obviously we've got more courses and we want to be growing and stuff. And I guess we should also talk, shouldn't we, about the Panavision interview coming up? The Andrew Collier and the Genesis camera. Because that's the rest of this podcast. We interviewed Andrew at Warner Brothers Studios on the day of the shoot, just discussing the development, I guess, of Genesis and the sort of films that had been used in and the workflow that we had on set.
Yeah, and it was great on set. And it's interesting because Photon used that workflow for Superman Returns. They actually had to figure it out in an incredibly short period of time, I think Steve was saying. And actually really ended up being quite happy with the results of it. And it's happened again, and it's happening more and more for me personally. But the idea of when you're working on set, the idea of working with a camera like that on set, the idea that you can see this incredible detail in the 1920 by 1080 LCD image when you're lighting something, especially doing effects work on set, it's great to be able to see everything that you're going to end up with on the tape too.
Yeah, I mean, much more than any other camera, this is a camera that replaces a film camera in a very equivalent sense. You can use film lenses on it, you can use film accessories on it. It even looks a bit like a film camera, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's sitting on that rig.
It's a big difference between, say, a Genesis or the Arri D20 or the top of the line Viper and the next level down where you get that kind of general HD camera, or the third level down where you get the domestic HDV stuff.
Yeah, they've worked really, really hard to make it appealing to people who are used to working with film. And again, you obviously have some caveats when you're working with it, but it's the footage is just gorgeous.
And we were lucky enough to have two Genesis cameras on set.
We're shooting B-roll of us on set using the Genesis camera.
It's like, yeah, it was
real. It's a little obscene.
Yeah. Yeah, but hey, that was incredibly kind of Panavision to, and, you know, that's them wanting to help students and postgrads of FX PhD, you know. The whole point of doing this was a training exercise, and, you know, we've had buy-in globally, really. Yeah. Like, there are so many companies that have bought in to the idea of FX PhD, and they're just falling over themselves to... I'm just stunned at the generosity of these.
Yeah, it really has, because we honestly couldn't have done this without the support. I mean, how many cameras are in Australia? How many Genesis?
We had all of the Genesis cameras in Australia on set. And you know what? Even the lighting. Like, at one point I was like, yeah, we're going to have to put up a really big light to get depth of field here, John. And John's like, yeah, whatever. I'm like, yeah, I think they're putting up a 10,000 watt. And he's like, yeah, whatever. And I walked over a couple of minutes later. Actually, John, I think Steve's putting up a...
100,000 watt. And it's like, zoink! My eyes, it's like, boing!
And we're sitting on set, and he's like, see, I'm going to fire up the soft sun now. And it goes up, and it's like what? A bomb going off. It was just like so bright. And you just hear this little voice in the background. That's it on the smallest dim setting. Like, what? It's it on the smallest, lowest, dimmer setting. And I'm like, okay then.
Yeah, boys and their toys. That's kind of, but you know what?
The lightning machine.
The lightning machine, that's what I was going to say. The strike machine was so cool as well.
One of the parties we went to after the shoot was at a theme resort type thing.
The Great Australian Outback.
Yeah, I was going to skip that bit. But
spectacular.
Anyway, the point is, during this 1,000 seat auditorium show, they have these lightning machines go off, and John and I look at each other going, pathetic. Call that lightning?
Give me a break.
Those ones on set, which were like, whatever you do, don't look at them if you ever want to see again.
Yeah, it was.
But you'll see all of that and more at FXPhD. And also, we're going to put up some samples of some of the EPs from last term, so you can actually see what some of the classes really look like. Because obviously, a lot of the classes are people sitting in front of workstations actually showing you which buttons to press and stuff, and walking you through shots and, you know, allowing you to follow along with them.
Why don't we go ahead and take a listen to your interview that you had with Andrew Collier on the set of our Term 2 shoot for FX PhD.
So, Andrew, how long has the Genesis been around?
Well, we've had it since Superman started shooting, which was the first job it went out on, and basically that's 2 years ago. So the first of them came out here 2 years ago. We were thrown in the deep end big time in Australia. We had to sort them out. They weren't quite ready for the job, so... We were making all sorts of brackets and knobs and things to make it work, so it was a real challenge for us.
How many are there now in the world?
Well, at the moment, there's about 50 of them in the world, and they're madly trying to make more because they've become quite a popular item.
So, in fact, we have 4% of the world supply of Genesis on set today.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Good. Well, we've
got to be wrapped
in
that.
To bump it or anything.
That's right.
But, I mean, when you say you're making brackets and stuff for it, surely the huge selling point of Genesis, apart from image quality, is it really is a cinematographer's camera. I mean, it is, to many respects, very similar to a 35 in...
Well, in a lot of respects, from the mount forward, from the mount towards you, is exactly like a cinema or a film camera. We've got a modular follow focus here, which is straight off a film camera. These lenses, this is a super speed lens that can go straight into any sort of motion picture camera or any of the Panaflex type motion picture cameras. The PSR matte box, these flaps are all straight off a motion picture camera.
Now, when I was in shooting before on the 900s, 950s and the 750s, and we wanted to put Panavision lenses on those cameras, they were very big because they were the digital primos.
That's right. Those lenses were specifically made for the F900. And one of the problems with it, the F900, is it's a 2/3 inch chip, which means the projection area is quite small in that camera, so the lenses had to be quite large frontal area to get the light into them and to give them a really better quality than a Fujinon or some of the other common lenses around.
So if I was to take this lens off now, inside is no longer a sort of relatively small CCD, it's what?
That's right. Well, the CCD in this camera is exactly the same size as a Super 35 16x9 frame, so it's actually 22x13.49mm, which is perfect for fitting these 35mm film lenses into it. It means this mount, the flange depth of this mount is exactly the same as on a motion picture camera. So all the characteristics of this lens on a film camera work here. So your depth of field tables, all that sort of thing, are identical.
And now that gives us great usability. The other great thing that's incorporated after the CCD is the fact that we've got an ability to record SR here. So tell us about that.
Well, Panavision, when they made this camera, were looking for the best possible recording deck that they could find. So obviously Sony is the leader in that area of the world. So basically they've gone with this SRW1 deck. It compresses down to MPEG-4. So this camera is putting out 444. When it hits the deck, it's down to MPEG-4. When you come out of this deck, you can uncompress it and put it into whatever.
Now, being a bit of an effects guy, what this means to me is in the old cameras, we had HD cam as the back on the, say, the 900, and that's 7:1, maybe you could argue it's 10:1 compression. And us effects guys didn't like that so much. We could work with it, but let's face it, it was hard work. This is SR at 10-bit, 444. This is like...
This is the cutting edge.
It doesn't get any better than
no,
this.
No, it does not get any better. The only way you could get better quality is to be going 100% out of the camera into a hard disk recorder or something.
Right.
Now, that is an alternative that has been considered, but at the moment the technology is not with us to make them compact enough.
Well, having said that, though, we can get a feed from this into our disk array on set. And
correct.
We're doing that today, aren't we?
That's correct. We can put a passive breakout box on the camera instead of this recording deck. Two cables run to whatever you're going to go into, and away you go.
So we've been filming today with a Milo rig, and that's what we've done for that, isn't it?
Yes, correct. It's one of the things about this camera is you can break the recorder off it and put it wherever you like. So, you know, one of the examples that I might use is you're on a Steadicam at the moment. This camera's too big for a Steadicam. You'd break it down, you take the recorder off it. You might have a guy following on behind with the recorder in a backpack or something like that. You could have him tethered with a couple of cables if you had to.
You've done that with helicopter shoots and stuff.
That's
you?
Right. One of the great things about this camera, you can put the main body of the camera on a side mount, say. You can have the director in the back of the helicopter with the recorder. He can be sitting there changing tapes as they run out, and what that means is the helicopter can fly around all day until it runs out of fuel. So,
because I've actually stood on the salt flats, and every time we got the car to do what it was meant to do, the chopper had to land and they had to reload.
That's right. If you're using film, most helicopter mounts will only take a 400-foot load on a motion picture camera. You're only getting 5 minutes.
Well, and we're always over-cranking because it's car.
That's it. So you're getting about 2 minutes.
Yep.
So 2 minutes and then you've got to land. It's ridiculous. So the upside of this camera, the quality of the image is so good now, it's almost or equal to 35mm. In situations where you're going to need you know, a helicopter's a great example because you're sort of $1,000 or $2,000 an hour while you're flying around, so it's a great cost saving.
But, I mean, being blunt about it, like, what about, you know, getting it out of the controlled environment of a studio with motion control and actually, you know, getting it out on the tracks and...
Well, Michael, I've spent quite a few weeks out and about with this camera, in particular with some of the DPs that like to put cameras through their paces. We were actually up this part of the world doing a Coors Light beer commercial and... We had everything. We had 45 degree days of heat. We had dust machines blowing red dust through and past the camera. We had it in helicopters. We had it on Steadicam. We had it going through everything, and it never missed a beat. So it's a, you know, it's an electronic camera, but it's a very well made and it's a very hardy electronic camera.
So let's talk about it in terms of the recording profiles now, the gamma curve. So maybe you could tell us what's going on there.
Panavision have decided that. The standard, an F900, for example, has a Rec 709 gamma curve, as all those sort of cameras do. Panavision, because of the type of information coming from the CCD here, looked at what they needed to do, and they've rewritten the gamma curve, and they've called it a Panalog. So this has a Panalog gamma curve in it, and it gives you a great deal of space or a great deal of information on the tape above and below, so your blacks and your whites, you get a lot of detail up and down. You've got about a 10-stop range.
10 stops?
Yeah,
wow.
10-stop range, which some people say that can't be right, but it's been tested and it seems to be the fact.
Well, actually, over on our on PhD, we're going to be doing LUTs to do the Panalog conversion to Cineon and Linear for After Effects, Flame and Shake. So we'll definitely be having a good look at that. And the cameras itself, I mean, what are they being used for? Because you mentioned Superman, I think, and a Coors commercial.
That's right. At the moment, we around the world, we've seen this camera used on about 20 different feature films around the world. Some of them are going to be more famous than others, I guess. We have seen around the world, probably at this stage, it's done 30 or 40 commercials. Now, in Australia, we've only seen it on 3 or 4 commercials.
But that's because it spent all its time on Superman. Right?
Yeah, that's right. Panavision would like to see more people in Australia using it on commercials. What we're saying is it's an alternative to a sync sound film camera, where we're obviously our mainstay is film cameras. 90% of our stock, or 99% of our stock, is film cameras. This is a very small part of our...
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, Panavision has no vested interest in the argument of film versus digital. It's just saying, if you want to shoot digitally, this is a good camera to use. If you want to shoot film, you have, like, millenniums and...
That's,
you know,
we've got a whole range of film cameras.
Quite good, actually.
That's right, the best range in the world in Australia, actually. But, you know, Panavision have decided that the HD world is approaching rapidly, and they need to...
Other than Superman Returns have actually been done?
We've got probably Flyboys is one that's going to come out soon here in Australia. That'll be a very good one, full of flying stunts, air-to-air stuff with this camera. It'll look spectacular. We've got...
was Click?
Click was one of them. Click's another one. Spooky... Scary Movie 4. I've just got a bit of a mind blank on what's been shot on it.
And, of course, one of the great things is there's a massive move to DI. And so it's not an inconsequential fact that it costs a heck of a lot of money to scan an entire feature. So I guess there is not only an issue about film stock and processing it up front, but once you get into effects-laden material, there's a heck of a lot of issues about, you know...
Well, that's one of the points about this camera is we have an HDSR tape in this camera. That's what the information is put onto. Now, the tape currently is about $120 for 48 minutes. Now, if you've got to convert film to 48 minutes worth of film, you're looking at thousands and thousands of dollars.
Well, I know from some friends that work in a few key places in LA that over the last, say, 5 to 7 years, the actual shooting ratio on normal feature film, normal features, 35mm, has been rising. The shooting ratio of what they're actually putting through each day, the amount of film that's processed and rushes, has been climbing because directors like shooting longer, like cutting less, and sometimes like shooting multi-cameras. And so did you sort of get a kick up in what sort of something like a Superman or a Click is doing in terms of how much they're shooting?
Their ratio. Look, I know on Superman, because I spent weeks out there, they would just roll on things continuously. And you know, if they had a film camera in the same situation, they would have cut. So an actor's doing a performance that's a bit tricky. They might just say, go again, go again, go again, 6 or 7 times.
Right.
With a film camera, they definitely would have shut it down. And there's big advantages there. While the person's, you know, on their sort of hot to trot, as it were, they'll get the good performance out of them. If they've got to stop them and then reposition them and do all the business they've got to do.
And if I'm not mistaken, they were actually sending stuff from Superman back via, like, SohoNet or whatever overseas. So there was actually, like, a whole interactive thing that they got the material, it was being dubbed, safeties were going. Is that right?
Well, I believe so. I'm not totally around what was being done, but I do know the rushes they were seeing for Superman. We were seeing the stuff the next day. It was graded. We were seeing it digitally projected in a little suite out there at Fox. And you were seeing perfectly graded, ready to view images, basically. And, you know, you can't do that with anything else.
We spoke to Dale from Photon, who generously helping us here on set with this project. And he was saying himself that he literally, on the miniature shoot for Superman Returns, went to go, let's go again for safety. And as he was saying the words, he went, actually, it's got it. You know, it's like, I can see that I've got it.
Exactly.
Because I think that's one thing that you really can't underestimate, what it's like to look at the monitor, look up at the set, look at the monitor and go, you know what, that's looking pretty good.
Well, you know, one of the things I heard on Superman, the camera assistant on that, on main unit, he's done films all around the world and he's mainly used film cameras, obviously. Working on Superman for 18 months with this camera, he walked away and he said, that's the best job that I've ever done. You could go home at night, sleep, because what he'd seen that day on the monitor, he knew worked, he knew it was in sharp focus, everything was good.
Yeah, that must be hell for some people on those killer, tricky manual focus pulls, not knowing until the set's broken.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and moved on.
Yeah, it's one of the things you can do with high-def images coming onto the monitor. Everyone can see what's going on. It's great.
So globally... Panavision's partnered with Sony, and yet the camera itself is a Panavision camera and was developed by you guys, right?
It's a co-production between Panavision and Sony, and clearly when you look at this camera, at a distance, some people mistake it for a film camera because the silhouette is film camera. You've got a magazine on top. It's a fat-bodied thing.
So you can actually move that at the back, right, for a...
That's
right. What you were saying before?
Yes, we can move the magazine, or well, it's not a magazine. It's a film transport or a tape transport, I should say. I'm getting it wrong now myself. The tape transport can go on the back. If you've got a long lens and you need to counterweight it, you can do it. So it's quite versatile that way. Panavision, when they designed this, were thinking of DPs who were going to transition from a film camera. They wanted them to feel comfortable with shooting on HD, so they've made a camera that is very similar in shape and weight to a film camera.
So let me ask you a couple of quick questions, just for people that maybe have shot with the older style cameras, things that were bugbears. Let's see if we fix them. So we can use normal lenses, so we don't have the weight of going to, say, a digital Primo, even though they were gorgeous, they were pretty friggin' big. The recording for the effects guys like me, we've pretty much got that to now a point we're not so concerned about it. Yep. There was back focus problems.
Because of the size of the CCD in this camera, the circle of confusion is such that back focus is not an issue anymore.
Right.
The lenses and the mount, when they're put together, temperature doesn't affect them. On the old F900, temperature did affect them, and you had a back focus change or adjustment you had to do at least twice a day. This camera has none of that. So the old headaches of the F900 back focus wise are gone.
Now, this obviously isn't an optical viewfinder because there's a cable here.
That's right.
Is focusing through that viewfinder good enough?
Yes, the viewfinder on this camera, this is a Sony colour viewfinder. We have another better, clearer viewfinder called an AccuScene, which you can use if focus is really critical. But this, the focus through this is quite easy and quite accurate.
Okay, and then the other problems we had was, of course, I guess related to some of the other lens issues, like could you work quickly because you were tethered, and you couldn't work because there were cables everywhere, and there was like tons of people with scopes everywhere, and there was the tech hut over here with the guys.
Yeah, the video away. Village and all the business.
But I mean, quite honestly, I've been watching what's been happening today, and every time Steve, the DOP, who's very experienced with Genesis, I must admit, but when he goes to look to set something, he's doing it with a light meter. He's not running over to the scope, even though we've got one. Do you find that to be common?
It's 50-50. Some guys, particularly on Superman, where they had a lot of green screen work, they were using the waveform monitor that you refer to as a way of actually lighting the green screen to the correct temperature.
Right.
And other guys, I've been out on other commercials where they don't have a waveform monitor at all. They do exactly that. This camera's rated at 500 ASA.
Okay.
Set the meter to 500, go about it just like you would for a film camera. So it can be made as easy or as hard as you like.
And the last thing I want to discuss, if we can, is some of the shooting modes, because when you're shooting miniatures, as we're doing here, there obviously are issues about opening it up, and there are a few accumulation modes and stuff. Can you just quickly give us an overview of some of those options at the edge of our kind of everyday use?
The typical, this camera in its normal mode, the gain does not change as you change camera speed. So because it's an electronic gathering camera, you can change camera speeds. Unlike a film camera where obviously you change camera speeds, you're going to lose or gain light.
Yep.
This camera doesn't have that issue. You can change the setting, however, so that as you slow the camera speed down, it'll work like a film camera. It'll actually, the gain will change or go up or down according to... So you've got options. The main reason that you might go to... I can't think of the...
But is this as complicated as the 900? Because that used to have like so many menus that, this has frankly, we never got to them.
This has all the menus that the 900 has in it.
Oh, really?
Except we don't want you to go there.
Okay.
There are standard settings in this camera,
yep.
And we have found by much testing that the settings that are in it are the desired way to use it. So all we want through this LCD panel, you can change camera speed, you can change shutter angle, you can change gain to a certain extent.
What shutter angles can I get?
You can go from zero, you can go from 1 to 360 degrees.
Right.
Speed-wise, you've got 1 to 50 frames.
So if I'm shooting 50 frames a second, I'm getting a proper 50p... Totally.
It's a when you're shooting variable rate, which 50 frames is.
Yes.
It's a setting in the camera whereby the tape recorder is actually running at a set speed, so it doesn't go faster and slower when you change speeds. What the recorder starts to do is buffer frames and put them down every 10 seconds onto the tape at the appropriate timing, so that it emulates the speed that you're trying to achieve. And it's what it means is at the end of the shot, you can rewind and actually view it straight up and see how it looks. So if you're dealing with cameras that don't have a tape deck like this, if you're dealing with hard drive cameras and stuff like that, you can't do that. You've got to process the information later and look at it later. So this is instant playback if you want it to be.
Okay. And just lastly, I need you to touch on the fact that when you get to those settings, we were talking before about setting tungsten versus daylight, but you're actually saying sort of almost literally stick with the camera and gel it. Is that right?
What we're saying with this camera, it does have the ability to be set tungsten or daylight colour temperature. The standard setting on this is tungsten, and we say that because if you want to go daylight, to achieve daylight internally, it has to put some electronic colouring in there. Now, we're saying don't do that. Leave it on tungsten. That way you're getting a pure image. If you need to filter it, put an 85 filter it like you would a film camera.
Right.
We've found through testing that gives you the best results.
So as opposed to being one of those cameras where you really need to tweak it to get the best out of it, you're actually saying to get the best out of it, leave it the fuck alone.
Just That's it. Get off. Don't fiddle.
Okay.
In fact, if we could lock people out of the interior menus, we would, but we can't. So it's one of those things that whenever I run someone through the using of the camera, I can't stress enough, don't touch anything except what I show you.
Well, we've been loving the pictures we've been seeing today, and thank you for letting us use 4% of the world's cameras. Thanks so much, man.
That's Panavision's pleasure. Yeah, fantastic.
Well, that was great. And again, I want to thank Andrew Collier for taking the time to talk to us, and not just take the time to talk to us, but supply us with two Genesis cameras
and the
kind of time. And he was there the whole weekend and answered questions from everybody. It was really nice.
Oh,
the lighting as well. Yeah, of course. It was really, really generous of him.
Now, listening to that, I have no idea why you let me do those things. I think you were, like, jet-lagged or something. Cause I don't know why.
You know what? I always roll off your low end and
you
add a little low end to me to make
so
it sound.
Much better, man.
To make it sound.
And Jeff sounds,
smooth.
Jazzy and
smooth
cool.
Jazz Jeff.
Who wanted to be with us, but unfortunately it was past 11 o'clock in Los Angeles. It was past his bedtime, so he couldn't join us today. Hey, so the other thing is we're going to put up a promo, right?
Yeah, there's going to be a promo. You can find it either on FXPHE, and it'll be part of our homepage story on FX Guide as well. It'll be linked to a little bit of a montage, so you can see actually a little bit of footage, a little bit of the scene, what the shoot was like up in Queensland. Something that was put together by our one of our profs, too, as well, the Final Cut Pro guru.
Yeah, Nick had fun doing that.
Yeah. So I'll kind of give you a taste of what the shoot was like, shows the Milo rig and everyone involved. It was a lot of fun. It was really we really tried, like as Mike mentioned earlier, I think, recreate that pipeline they used for the film. And it was really, really cool.
And I just want to thank everybody that's been contributing. It's been a year now of the podcast and about 6 years of FX Guide. And every week we get emails from people, and it makes a huge difference to us. I mean, honestly, even the ones commenting on my door at home. And
door squeaking.
Or my mobile phone or whatever it is that there has taken the...
Which I actually oiled, by the way, so we won't have that anymore.
I'm sure I needed to oil my mobile phone. But anyway, it's been way fun, and we really... You know, the forums on FXPHD, the forums on FX Guide, and, of course, the emails. Just keep.
We love hearing from people, too.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. It's great, especially, you know, given how wide the reach is of people around the world that actually listen to the podcast and stuff. It's great.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a lot of fun. Really, really makes the world feel a lot smaller.
I think at some point we're going to have to get some FX Guide t-shirts and then give away something if people wear them and send us photos in front of Icelandic monuments, or, you know, take your photo on the Eiffel Tower with an FX Guide t-shirt and win an iPod. I don't know. Something. We'll come up with something in a later ep.
Yeah, exactly.
And speaking of later eps, next week should be good, but you'll probably be back in the US of A.
Yeah, I will. Regrettably, I'm going to have to head back.
Yeah.
I'd like to just hang out here, but work to be done, so we'll be talking from there.
And we've got some really good stories coming up. We've had some stories. Actually, it's funny. Some of the stories that you see on FX Guide actually take, honestly, about 6 months to come to fruition.
Yep.
And we have a couple of those coming up. So I've been working on them for the longest time. So we're looking forward to those. And again, thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate you taking the time to listen. As always, again, if you have an idea for a story or an idea for a podcast, be sure to drop us a line. We'll read each and every one of your emails. So I won't take up any more of your time this week. Thanks for listening. For Jeff Huser in Los Angeles and Mike, I'm Jim Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide, LLC.